I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Welcome to Mind Over Matter, a monthly radio show that explores issues of the heart as well as of the mind. And we're live on the air tonight. Tonight's show will focus on the emotional lives of children and teenagers, particularly those young people who have significant adjustment and developmental problems. And to contribute his expertise, I have with me in the K2 studio Dr. Mark Stauffer, a child psychiatrist who is on the staff at Bartlett Regional Hospital's outpatient mental health clinic. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Elaine.
Yes. Well, let's get going, and I'm always curious about how somebody became entered into the profession that they did. And so I'm just curious, how did you happen to choose child psychiatry as a medical specialty?
Yes, well, I started out as a pediatrician up in Fairbanks, and over the course of that time, I became interested in the psychosocial welfare of the children that I was seeing and saw a big need up in Fairbanks for child psychiatry, which we didn't have. I went back and did some training and became certified in adult psychiatry and then child psychiatry.
So after training as a pediatrician, what kind of additional training did you need for child psychiatry?
I went back and did another residency in adult psychiatry, which was a couple of years, and then a fellowship in child psychiatry, which was a couple more.
Mm-hmm. Wow, so 4 more years after being a pediatrician. But what a combined for your patients. What a wonderful combination, because you can look both at the neurological, the psychological, and the whole body medical.
Yes, so it's wonderful developmentally, yes,
really,
to have the background.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Bartlett's lucky to have you. Good. Now, I understand that two of the developmental issues that you have focused on are ADHD and autism. So let's start with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or we'll call it ADHD. And I remember when I was a graduate intern at the University of Washington's adolescent clinic, this diagnosis was just beginning to surface, so that was a long time ago, Could you tell me a little bit of the history of ADHD as a diagnosis?
Yes, back in the 40s and 50s, it was known as minimal brain dysfunction and encompassed a whole slew of conditions, including learning disorders and attention problems and traumatic brain injuries. It was all called minimal brain dysfunction. Over the years, we've been able to kind of sort out and select out various disorders and have been able to isolate more attention problems. At first, it was called attention deficit disorder,
right.
And that's where you hear the term ADD.
Right.
And then later on, as the diagnostic and statistical manual for psychiatry evolved, it became known as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And there are three subtypes. There is the inattentive subtype and the hyperactive subtype, and then the more common is the combined subtype that includes both inattention as well as hyperactivity and impulsivity.
Now, I would presume that symptoms are on sort of a scale of say, minimal hyperactivity or minimal attention deficit going all the way to extreme. How do you draw the line? How do you, where's the line drawn for a child? Is there a way to draw the line between, because it would be on a continuum, would it not?
Yes, it is on a continuum because most children are at least somewhat hyperactive and somewhat inattentive.
Mm-hmm.
But if it begins to, or if it interferes with their schooling or their home functioning or their functioning in the community or with their peers or causes emotional distress, that's where we consider it to be impairing and sometimes needs special attention or
mm-hmm.
treatment.
Okay, well, that makes sense. And then certainly that's at the point where parents would possibly seek out help when they got feedback from teachers or they just wondered if their kid especially a preschooler, had something wrong with them. Do you get many parents coming in with, say, a jumpy preschooler where they're unnecessarily worried?
Yes, sometimes. It's not frequent, but yes, I do get preschoolers.
Right, right. Do you feel that ADHD is primarily caused by how an individual's brain is wired? In other words, is it organic? Or, on the other hand, do you think it's caused, ADHD is caused, or at least exacerbated by environmental factors?
The information that we have to date indicates that it's most likely to be genetic, and we know that it runs in families. It can be associated with some environmental factors. We know that prematurity is associated with ADHD, as well as cigarette smoking when the mothers are pregnant, or with fetal alcohol exposure during pregnancy.
Well, I was just thinking, because I remember a situation where I was working with a family, and this is not ADHD is definitely not my area of expertise, but I was working with a family where it appeared to me that the environment was chaotic, not in a dysfunctional way, but just really hyper. And their child, that's where they came in. They wanted to talk about their child who had been diagnosed with ADHD. And I just thought, wow, if this is genetic, a untreated or undiagnosed parent could have an environment, like with TVs going on over the place and lots of electronic gadgets and just a hyper environment, that would then increase the probability that their genetic offspring would both have an organic cause as well as an environmental cause. It's the same as if a depressed parent is raising children and they have the children have inherited a tendency towards depression. Having a depressed parent can be depressing. So anyways, do you see ever have that where the parent, you treat the parent as well as the child?
Well, I see it commonly in parents and often refer them for their own treatment. You're right that sometimes parents with ADHD can have more chaotic households. How that translates to the child's life is very hard to distinguish what is genetic and what is environmental.
Yeah.
And there's probably some of both.
Yeah, how do you know? Has there been, do you think, do you think there's been an actual increase in ADHD or an increase in diagnosis?
Yes, in a conference in October from the National Organization for Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, we learned that in the past the incidence has been around 7% for children, and now it's approaching 12%. And I think part of that is because we're getting much better at diagnosing it, especially in girls who are not necessarily particularly hyperactive but still may have problems with inattention. And we know that in adults, it's persistent more than we thought it was 10 years ago.
What do you... so you said possibly it's the increase in the incidence could be due to the increase in diagnoses. What about environmental changes? Do you think there's any... Because often you could have somebody who might have a tendency towards something, but then put them in an environment that... creates more of a tendency to be hyperactive, a home that is chaotic, for example. So do you think there's been any social changes that has increased the incidence?
There have been some studies on whether or not television viewing in young children causes ADHD, and there have been some associations, although we don't necessarily know that that means it's causative. But
well, I wouldn't research be fairly, I think, fairly simple of if you had a large number of subjects to see the impact of, let's say, video games, because those are ubiquitous now and something fair, the real heavy duty video games, the violent ones particularly. I think they've done correlation studies about violent TV or violent video games and children acting out, have they?
Yes, there have been a number of studies, but like I say, they can identify associations between viewing and violence. Mm-hmm. We don't know yet whether it's a causative factor, if there are other genetic factors or other environmental factors.
Yeah, yeah. Now with all the research that's been done around neuroplasticity, mm-hmm. that will further muddy, I think, the field, because nature-nurture is no longer a distinct thing, that one's environment, especially as an infant and young child, can shape the brain.
That's right. Brain circuits are modified all the time. And it can be based on experiences, what kind of information we feed into our brain, what we spend our time doing, what we spend our time thinking. Those circuits are strengthened or they're weakened all the time by how they're used.
Right. And I think that the research I've read on adults, not on children, has taken a look at the amount of time that adults spend on internet. I've seen one study is directly correlated with their depression scores. In other words, the more time they spend on internet. This is an American Psychological Study Association study. The more time you spend on internet, the more depressed you are. I've read that. Also, interesting things about social skills, but not being able to focus and complete articles and books, that there was one study that wired people up, and it took a look at the difference between reading a hard copy of a newspaper and reading the newspaper online. And what they found was that people skip, jump around when they're online. They don't read articles as likely. They're not as likely to focus in depth on an article and go in depth. In fact, the articles aren't as likely to be in depth. If you take a look at Huffington Post, they're real short.
Mm-hmm.
They jump around compared to somebody who is reading a hard copy of a newspaper is much more likely to pick and choose and go in depth and read the whole article. And you know, the speculation is it's slowly changing the way our brains can tolerate concentration to pay attention.
Yes, it's strengthening or weakening different circuits.
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly. What about other impacts of kids' use of electronics? What else have you seen?
Well, I think one of the biggest impacts is on the time that it takes from healthy physical activity, especially for young children, from creative playtime, from their imagination, and from time with their families.
I notice that. And I often notice, I have a 2.5-year-old granddaughter, and I'll take her to the park, to Twin Lakes, with that wonderful little magical land at Twin Lakes. And I'll see a lot of parents sitting there on their smartphones. And the kid comes up and wants to talk or interact with the parent, and the parent doesn't enjoy being interrupted. So it's very interesting to see how this rapid change in technology could be rapidly changing the amount of attention parents give to kids.
That's right.
Because they're so distracted.
That's right.
And I've read some very interesting research in a book called Alone Together from a social psychologist from MIT. And she took a look at teenagers' use of social media, specifically Facebook. What she found out was that kids who had more fragile emotional lives were more devastated, in fact, quite devastated by Facebook, because what they tended to do is perceive on Facebook that all the other kids are having a lot of fun. They, you know, because when you put up a false self on Facebook, you're
right.
Not going to talk mm-hmm. about who mm-hmm. you really are. You talk about all the good things that you really are. They can't, often a teenager, especially one with very low self-esteem or depression, can't necessarily fathom this. It's they just look at all the parties that people have had and all the parties they weren't invited to, because that's a new phenomenon. You see all these social activities that you're not part of, as long as you're friends with the person on the page. And so what Sherry Turkle is the author of this, what she found is that the more emotionally fragile kids could be very their problems could be exacerbated by spending a lot of time on social media. Also, if they spend a lot of time on social media, what are they doing? They're not out playing. They're not out
That's
connecting
right.
with people.
Mm-hmm.
They're sitting home alone. I've had a lot of this with particularly clients of mine, depressed young adult males. They're either on dating sites or they're just playing games, solitaire games, fooling around on internet for hours and hours. I've also had experience when I'm doing family counseling, problems where parents are totally addicted and they don't pay any attention to their kids. So we've got a real big challenge here. And there's some other things going on too, I would imagine. Have you had any experience with kids and cyberbullying?
Yes. Yes, it can be pretty bad. There is a wonderful documentary called Bullies that demonstrates how powerful bullying can be, not just in the schools but over the internet. Relational aggression, especially among females who tend not to physically bully others but to bully through relationships, can do that through the internet and on Facebook. One person I saw recently had been bullied and on the bus, and someone else was taking a video of the bullying, and they were threatening to post it on YouTube. And I just can't imagine, you know, how this child must have felt.
Wow.
As this was going on.
YouTube. We forgot about YouTube. Because you can, yeah, you could take embarrassing pictures of people.
Right.
The research, the MIT research also found out that kids were losing verbal skills. The skills to be able to interact and have, we'll call it conversational skills. In fact, I don't know if you've noticed this, you have kids, but a lot of kids do not use their smartphones anymore as a telephone. They just text and they don't pick up the phone. They don't even have they never go on their so-called answering machine.
Mm-hmm.
And when Sherry Turkle interviewed kids, they just said, it's too awkward. I don't want to call people. I don't know what to say. I don't know how to get off the phone. And all of a sudden, I realized that when you grow up with a telephone, you learn automatically what you don't realize is actual telephone skills or telephone etiquette.
That's right. Or even person-to-person skills.
Yeah.
Sometimes are lacking.
Right. And I think there's been some books out about boys who don't talk. In other words, young males losing actual verbal skills more than girls do, because they're more likely, adolescent boys may spend more time on internet.
Yes, if a child or teenager is anxious, they may be more likely to spend more time on the internet because they can use that as an avoidance mechanism, and then they spend more and more time on the internet, less and less time with people. They're not put out of their comfort zone at all, and it just creates a narrowing and more and more narrow world for them. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it snowballs. Have you ever heard of Mary Pfeiffer? She's a child psychologist, and she is pretty well known in my field and at conferences I go to. But she wrote a book called The Shelter of Each Other, and this is, you know, a while ago it was published. I really recommend it to parents because she makes a strong and eloquent plea for how to raise kids, and one thing is to turn off the electronics and spend time together as a family. So she, and that's a book that I love to hand out because they could save several hours of therapy if they read that book. Because I notice some parents feel, I would say, disempowered. When I grew up, and I don't know if this is the same for you, I was not allowed to receive phone calls after 9 o'clock. I was not allowed to make phone calls after 9 p.m. And we had one telephone in the house. And so nobody could sneak in the middle of the night. They couldn't sneak a phone call to me. And so there was more parental supervision. I work with parents who are stunned when I say, I want you to remove the electronics from your kid's bedroom and the cell phone.
Yes.
What?
This is a major problem. I see it frequently that teenagers aren't getting sleep because they're spending it all night either on the internet or texting or doing other electronics that keep them up all night.
I saw some statistics on that, and it was really high. It was something like 63% of kids between 12 and 18 are on their cell phones or smartphones in the middle of the night, a real high number.
Yes.
And sometimes it's going to be monkey see, monkey do, because they may be watching their parents doing exactly the same thing. In other words, waking up in the middle of the night, going and looking at their email. I know people who do that.
Mm-hmm.
And just spending all hours on the Internet. So it's kind of hard to tell your kid not to do it if you're doing it yourself.
Yes, and it's not just new electronics. Televisions in children's bedrooms are also a major problem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about your feeling about medications for ADHD.
Okay. There have been a number of studies on ADHD in terms of what helps the most, behavioral interventions or medications, and they've found that behavioral methods don't work any better than medications, and if you use behavioral interventions and medications together, you don't get any benefit in addition to using medication alone. Because the condition is so biologically based, there is a strong biochemical basis for the condition that the medications can help, that if a person is impaired enough that it's interfering with their academic and their school situation, their home situation, and their peer relationships, usually I go ahead and recommend medications, although there do need to be some behavioral or environmental modifications at the school, which include preferential seating at the front of the class, additional time on tests, testing done in a distraction-free environment, shortened problem lists, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. And is this easy to get for one's child, these accommodations?
They come pretty standard with a 504 plan. Those are accommodations that the teacher can implement in the classroom without requiring special education, as long as the teacher is willing to implement those.
Mm-hmm.
Teachers have a big responsibility with, 20 to 30 children in a classroom and implementing a 504 plan for all the kids that have ADHD, I can imagine it's a big job.
You can't put them all in the front of the class.
Yeah, that's right.
In the front of the class is so they're not distracted by the kids, by other kids. Is that right? So they have more of a beeline to what the teacher is saying.
That's correct. And they don't have so many children sitting in front of them distracting them.
Right.
We know that the behavioral interventions work only when those interventions are in place. In other words, if the child gets into another environment that doesn't have the one-on-one kind of attention that they're getting in the classroom, they're not any more likely to attend than if they had not had the intervention in the classroom.
Any problems with the medication? Any side effects?
There are a couple of classes of medications. There are the stimulant medications. There are two families of stimulant medications. That's the methylphenidate family, which is commonly considered the Ritalin family, and the amphetamine family, which is known mostly by Adderall. There are also two non-stimulant medications that are fairly effective, but the gold standard really are the stimulant medications.
Mm-hmm. The side effects?
The side effects of the stimulant medications can be poor appetite. Sometimes we have difficulty getting the child to gain weight.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes difficulty sleeping, sometimes stomach upset, and sometimes it hypes them up more than they were before. There are always, possibilities for side effects, and especially if you're using them in a child who has an environmental reason for them to be having ADHD, such as fetal alcohol exposure or from influenza or a traumatic brain injury, they may be more likely to respond to stimulant medications with becoming agitated or more hyper.
Okay. We touched on this a moment ago, but I'm going to ask you just your view on what kind of home environment changes would you recommend or do you recommend?
For children with ADHD?
Yeah.
I would recommend having the family computer in a central place. I would have the access to the internet, actually to electronics, stopped 1 to 2 hours before bedtime to allow the brain a chance to settle down. Keeping the lights low and a low stimulation environment for that last hour or two in the night is really helpful for them.
Because they have trouble going to sleep?
And having a bedtime routine so that they know this comes first, this comes next, this comes next, this comes next, and the brain gets conditioned to lead into sleep, which is a difficult thing for a lot of kids with ADHD. Their sleep cycle is often disrupted.
Yeah. I've heard some people say that there's some light emitted from a screen so that no matter who you are, you should not be on a screen for at least an hour before you plan to turn off the lights.
That's right. The light goes through the eye into the retina and stimulates the pineal gland, which is what secretes the brain's own melatonin. The melatonin is the hormone that helps us go to sleep at night. And so if we've got light coming in our eyes, it's disrupting the production of melatonin.
But I heard that it's the kind of light that's in a screen that's different than, say, having a light bulb on and you're reading a book. Do you know anything about that, that the kind of light that's emitted from a computer screen?
I don't know about the wavelengths, but the content of what's on a computer screen is different than just reading a book. I mean, you're getting these flashing images and sound bites, and
you're right.
It's high stimulation material.
Yeah.
Compared to reading a book under an incandescent light.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. Hey, well, this is a great time to take a short break with some good music. You are listening to Mind Over Matter, and I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and my guest is Dr. Mark Stauffer, and we will be back real soon.
Todo.
Listening to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and my guest is Dr. Mark Stauffer, a Juno child psychiatrist on the staff at Bartlett Regional Hospital. And we have just talked about ADHD, and we are now going to talk more about developmental mental health conditions that affect children and their families. So welcome back to our discussion, and I would like to shift gears a little bit, Mark, and talk about your work with children who have been diagnosed with autism.
Okay.
And I understand that you mentioned the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual, the DSM-5, the new one, has recently made some changes in the diagnosis. But we should first talk about have you give your own description of autism?
Yes, autism. Let's see, my own description. I'd rather give the DSM description.
Go for it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good.
The new DSM criteria includes information about a child's social relatedness, their ability to read nonverbal cues, mm-hmm. to understand nonverbal cues, and to give nonverbal cues through their facial expressions, eye contact, body gestures, those kinds of things. That's one domain. Another is repetitive behaviors, which include high interest areas that are quite consuming to them, that sometimes exclude to the exclusion of their education or their family life.
So I remember working with a family where their child would just, and the child was a toddler, would just pick at the rug just repeatedly. Is that kind of repetitive behavior? Could you give some examples of what that might be?
Yes. Sometimes it's hand flapping. Sometimes it's twirling. Sometimes it's rocking. Often it's subtle things that aren't quite as obvious as that, but that gives you the general idea.
Okay.
It also includes the need for sameness, the difficulty making transitions from one activity to another, mm-hmm. Those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
And then a third area that's covered is sensory issues. For example, difficulty handling loud noises, large crowds, not liking the texture of their clothing, being very picky about that, mm-hmm. Food textures, sensitive to light, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the three areas that are included in the present definition of autism.
And so there's no longer a diagnosis of Asperger's disorder, right? They've changed that now. It's all on a continuum.
That's right. It's Asperger's disorder is still there in parentheses, but it's not the official diagnosis anymore. What used to be considered the autism spectrum disorders was called pervasive developmental disorders. And within that whole spectrum of disorders, there was a definite criteria set for autism, a definite criteria set for Asperger's disorder, and then everything else in that spectrum was called pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a very good way to describe what was going on with the child. Now, with the DSM-5, it's much better because it's all considered autism spectrum disorder, but we describe it by whether or not there is intellectual impairment.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the same as the old terminology of mental retardation. Whether or not there is language impairment, that doesn't include social communications. It's mostly language development, whether or not there's an impairment in the use of language itself, not in its social use.
Mm-hmm.
And then we grade it also in different levels, 1, 2, or 3, from the least to the most severe, mm-hmm. of how severe the social impairments are and how severe the repetitive behaviors are. So a child, say, with Asperger's disorder 6 months ago might now be considered as having autism spectrum disorder without intellectual or language impairment, but with social communications needing substantial support and repetitive behaviors requiring substantial support.
What percentage of children diagnosed with autism would have severe intellectual deficits? Do you have any idea? I mean,
I can't give you a percentage, but I guess the ballpark would probably be around 25%.
Could someone with autism be extremely intelligent or a genius?
Oh, yes.
And do we have some examples?
Yes, Einstein, Mozart.
Oh, yes. Einstein?
Yes.
Was autistic?
Yes. Well, today he would be definitely classified as as having an autism spectrum disorder.
What were his symptoms?
Difficulties with social communications, mostly.
Oh, mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
I don't know what kind of repetitive behaviors he might have had.
Yeah, right. But it's mainly his social impairment was pretty severe?
Yes. Well, it was enough to...
I haven't read his life... So I didn't know that.
Yes.
And you said Mozart?
Mozart, mm-hmm.
Anybody else? Any?
Microsoft.
Microsoft?
Who was he? Can't remember his name. I'm blocking
Not
it right
Bill
now.
Gates.
Yes, Bill Gates.
Really?
I believe so, yes. Uh-huh.
Oh, so he's, mm-hmm. he's and it, because of social deficits?
Yes, I mean, we think of... Often scientists having, they may be crazy brilliant, but having a difficult time managing at a party,
mm-hmm.
for example.
You think of scientists that way?
And some scientists, engineers, yes,
uh-huh.
there are a number of professions that attract people with
I'm
personality.
Kind of laughing because as an undergraduate, I got a job in the engineering department. And I wrote their newsletter, and I was a liberal arts. I was a French major, so I was a liberal arts major, and I really noticed the difference in personalities in the engineering department. First of all, they weren't very literate, and so me as an undergraduate, I wrote their newsletter, and the material I would get was fairly illiterate. But also, I noticed that it was that stereotype of sort of the geeky engineer, and so that's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know the cause of autism?
Well, this is an area of intense research right now. We believe that the most likely cause is genetic. There have been a number of syndromes identified that are definitely genetic, including Fragile X syndrome, Rett syndrome. Those are conditions that have a genetic basis and also include autism.
Could you explain the two? What the signs of those two different Fragile X and Rett?
Rett syndrome occurs mostly in girls, and a child will have normal development up until age 2 or 3 years old, and then they'll have a regression in their development and stereotypic behavior, especially with their hands and hand wringing or hand washing movements, and decline in their intellectual function. Fragile mm-hmm. X is one of the most common causes of mental retardation mm-hmm. and autism-type okay. features.
Uh-huh.
But most autism does not include either one of those. Most autism is considered polygenic. In other words, it's a combination of genes that come down from both sides of the family and combine in such a fashion to produce in a family member the full autistic picture. Autism does run in families. A child who has a sibling is likely to have... A sibling of a child with autism has a higher risk of autism than a child without a sibling who has autism.
Can you do genetic testing? In other words, could there be any prediction?
Yes, every child with autism, at least fairly severe autism, should have a genetic consult with a geneticist. And we do have consultation available here in Juneau a couple of times a year from the Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland.
Well, let's say, go on.
And they will recommend whether or not a child needs to have specific genetic testing. The yield for getting the testing, it's very expensive testing for one thing, and the yield is pretty low because most of autism is this polygenic variety that's very hard to isolate right now, but every year they're making progress in this field, and even in the last 5 years,
well,
the tests have advanced.
Let's say one sibling was autistic, and you're about to get married, and you're scared because you've read about the genetic tendency. Would there be any way to get genetic testing for that individual without autism but has a sibling with autism?
If the sibling with autism had a definite syndrome that could be identified genetically, the chance of giving a percentage would be higher than if it was of the garden variety polygenic kind,
okay,
which basically we would say, yes, there is a 15-20% chance that you may have some form of, you may have a child with some form of autism.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel there's been an increase in autism?
That's a good question. We didn't think so 4 or 5 years ago. The last that I learned at the conference that I went to, which included a day on autism, was that we're identifying more children under a broader spectrum than we did initially. Initially, the criteria for autism were pretty strict and pretty severe.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we're looking at it as a spectrum disorder, we're identifying more and more mild cases.
Right. So you expand the definition and you get more cases.
Right.
But you,
it's been expanding long before the DSM-5 came out.
But you, in your practice, if you were to, I mean, for a psychotherapist like me, a psychiatrist like you that's been around for decades,
mm-hmm.
we can have a sense possibly of family changes, of various changes. Do you see anything in your practice that would say there's more of an increase?
Well, I think in my practice, it's more because I see children with autism, so I get more and more referrals, right?
Yeah, right, and you specialize in that.
But I do think that autism is being identified more frequently in the community,
yeah,
because the awareness is increasing.
Well, one of the reasons I'm asking that is because of the belief system that vaccinations may cause autism.
That's a really good point. There's been considerable research on the autism question, and there is ample evidence to lead us to believe that vaccines do not cause autism. There is very little evidence that shows that it does cause autism. And I know that that's been a subject of study for decades, but we haven't found anything conclusive that would link the two.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. And did your children, were they vaccinated?
Yes, my kids were.
Okay.
You bet.
Okay. Okay. So it's more prudent to vaccinate, definitely.
That's right. People don't remember the days of polio and smallpox and...
Right.
Even back when I was a pediatrician, Haemophilus influenza meningitis was a very common condition,
mm-hmm.
and now it just hardly ever happens.
Right, right.
And vaccines really make us a safer place.
What about treatment? What can parents do? What can be done if a child is autistic?
Early identification is really critical. And so the earlier a child is identified and receives the intensive interventions, behavioral interventions particularly, the better they will do. One of the newest findings with autism, and this is just in the last few weeks, is that researchers have found that up to the first 2 months of life, children, babies with autism, will make normal eye contact with their caregivers, and that the eye contact isn't lost until after 2 months. Between 2 and 6 months of age is when that skill is lost. And so we're thinking that the brain is developing more normally up until that point. There's something that turns on or turns off in the brain at that point.
Turns on a gene or turns it
right,
off.
Right, or how it's expressed. So the thought is, if we can intervene at that 2 month mark or before the 2 month mark and engaging the child with looking at faces, that may help their social relatedness later on.
Well, this might bring us into epigenetics and gene expression.
Yes.
And any research on that?
Epigenetics is a huge area in research right now, especially in psychiatry. The body and the brain function are not solely the result of our DNA sequence. For example, identical twins, as identical as they might be, are not perfectly identical. The gene expression from our DNA is modified by proteins that can either amplify or suppress the genetic information on our DNA. So there are proteins in the cell that affect the expression that comes from the messages from the DNA.
Mm-hmm.
In a broader sense, epigenetics can mean anything that happens after the gene is transcribed. And that could include, for example, fetal alcohol exposure.
Mm-hmm.
Or, as we talked about before, maternal cigarette smoking or prematurity. Those are also considered, in a broad sense, epigenetics. But
okay.
In the narrow sense, it's stuff that happens in the cell.
Yes.
That affects the transcription of the proteins.
Right. So one identical twin could be autistic or schizophrenic, and the other not.
Not necessarily.
No?
I mean, they would have a really high risk, but
both would have a high risk.
But studies would show that perhaps, you know, 95% would have autism and the other 5% wouldn't. In other words, they're still pretty identical, but they're not, you know, if you lined up 100 twin pairs, maybe 95% of them would be concordant for autism and the other 5% wouldn't.
That's pretty strong evidence for genetic inheritance.
Yes.
If 95% of twins...
Of identical twins. Yeah.
Would share...
I don't know about the exact percentile.
Right.
I was just giving you an example. Right.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Okay, we're going to take a real short break now with some more good music. And we're going to be right back. And I'm going to talk to Dr. Stauffer about some of the changes in how children's mental health problems are treated. And I'm also going to ask Dr. Stauffer to share his wisdom about healthy families and skillful parenting. Mm-hmm. So be right back.
Maple or pay severe.
back to our discussion about children's mental health. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and tonight my guest is Dr. Mark Stauffer, and we are live on K2. We've just been talking about children's developmental conditions such as autism and ADHD, and what I'd like to do right now is, in the minutes we have left on the show, I just really get the big picture from an expert who has worked with children for decades, first as a pediatrician and then as a child psychiatrist. So, Mark, what do you see are some of the changes, if there are changes, in the way children's mental health and behavioral problems are being treated today compared to when you first began working in the field?
Well, today we have many more evidence-based treatments. For behavioral treatments as well as medication treatments. The behavioral treatments include cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavior therapy, exposure and response, prevention. That one is for OC, obsessive compulsive disorder. So the field has become more precise in terms of targeting specific conditions with specific treatments that are research-based and shown to have efficacy.
Sure. And what about, what's your opinion of prescribing psychoactive medications to children, say, aside from ADHD, but for depression or OCD? What do you feel?
Obsessive compulsive disorder, really, the best treatment for that is therapy with exposure and response prevention. And if a child or a teenager is not able to engage in the process of therapy because they're so anxious, then medications can be helpful for that. Some therapies can be helpful for depression, but if it's severe and a child is suicidal and not responding to psychosocial interventions, then medication can be a life-saving treatment. So,
Okay, so what about some reported increase in incidence of suicide with children and teens who take antidepressants? What's the
What you may be referring to is some research that indicates that about 2% of depressed children taking antidepressants may have an increase in suicidal thinking or gestures, but not an increase in completed suicides.
Okay, compared to kids who are not on antidepressant medication.
Right. So if I'm seeing children or adolescents with depression, there are a number of them who may become more suicidal or more depressed on medication, and we just have to follow very closely for that and change the medication or the treatment if that's happening, because it can happen in about 2%, and I have seen that happen. But the research doesn't bear out that there is an increased absolute number of suicides. In fact, the number needed to the medications do much more good than they do harm in a public health standpoint, perspective.
Right. You, over the years, have worked with hundreds of families and have observed the impacts of parenting. And I would imagine that when you're working with children with ADHD or depression or autism spectrum disorder, you're also working with the parents because these kids are more challenging to raise and they take a lot more skill. So, what do you think are some of the best ways to raise healthy kids?
I think it's really important that we do everything that we can to preserve intact nuclear families, because I've seen the difficulties that kids face when their parents divorce.
Oh, yes.
So if there is a way to preserve that family, that needs to be undertaken, first of all. Keeping home that's based on principles of respect and compassion, love, work, wholesome physical activities, recreational activities, attention to spiritual health, keeping the amount of criticism and conflict low in the home, right, using a low tone of voice are mm-hmm. all really important.
Well, a lot of it, anger management for the parents.
That's right.
Especially with kids that are have developmental difficulties or are depressed, it's added challenge.
That's right. That's
much,
right.
It's much more stressful. And, you know, this brings up the services for parents and families and children. Parent training, parent support groups for kids with disabilities.
That's right. That can be very helpful.
What kind of support services do you refer people to in Juneau?
For children with autism, we have a wonderful support group through Catholic Community Services. It's called Our Time, and it meets at Aldersgate Church at 6 o'clock on Mondays, I believe.
Oh, great.
And the parents get together while the children are playing in another place under supervision, and the parents can give each other support and exchange ideas. It's not necessarily a group for autism. It's for kids with developmental disabilities.
Of all kinds.
But I think a major proportion of them are parents of children with autism.
And do you ever refer people to the NAMI support group for parents?
NAMI has a wonderful program for families with family members who have severe mental illness.
Right.
And that can be very helpful.
Right. I've had the director here on the show, so we've talked a lot about the NAMI support groups for family
mm-hmm.
members, and that would be, in your case, mm-hmm. parents of children who have serious mental health or developmental issues.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. So we are just about out of time. And, Mark, I'd like to thank you. I want to thank Dr. Mark Stauffer for his insights this evening and for coming in.
Thank you, Eileen.
And my able techie assistants, who we have worked together for years and years now. I don't know how many years, but John and Dolly Kramers, who you will see all around town on their bicycles because they just got back from where? The El Camino in Spain. Right, a long trip. So I'd like to say good night to our Southeast Alaska listeners. Please tune in next month, Monday, December 2nd, at 7 p.m. on K2 for another, hopefully interesting discussion. Good night, all.